Hello and welcome to the first episode of the third season of The Whistleblowers. I'm News and Observer sports columnist Luke DeCock. With me, John Clockerty, the Hall of Fame official, basketball referee. I didn't know that we'd make it to a third season, John.
Yeah, and at the end of last season, we saw it picking up a little more listeners and some call-ins, actually. And now we're hopefully maybe we can start getting some guests on here so they can listen to somebody other than you and I.
I don't know why anyone would want to do that. You're clearly the star of the show, John, but we'll talk about that a little later, about some guests we might have on, other things we could do. I'll throw it right out at the top. If anyone ever wants to sponsor this, we'll take your money. We'll come and do it at your bar or restaurant. We'll do this live. You wouldn't believe how exciting it is to see this in person.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but we'll hope we can get a sponsor and then make it a little more exciting.
Let's jump right into basketball, John. Not a year for rule changes. No big points of emphasis this year, but there's a couple sort of little points of emphasis that they're talking about in the game. What do we got this year?
Well, I think the rules committee and even conferences and TV people and everybody else sees delays in the game. So we had a rule in which the rule was in place, Luke, where teams had to get out after the second horn and get ready to play on the floor, put the ball in play at the second horn. But it was a struggle to get them out of there. And the penalty for that was not a technical foul, but put the ball in play, put it down, start your count. And teams would come rushing out there while the ball was on the floor. And in some cases, it led to an easy hoop. If the defense wasn't out there, the offense put it in, and it led to – and it just wasn't the best situation. So what they've done now is put a penalty on it as a technical foul. If you get one warning, your team has to be out, ready to play by the second horn. If you're not, either a delay by the players or a delay by the coaches, you will get a warning.
And most of the time, it's the coach keeping the players in his huddle.
Yeah, but the other thing that happens, teams will also huddle up. They'll come out on the floor after on the second horn, and they'll huddle up.
Sure.
And they're not supposed to huddle up. Or even after a made basket, they can hit the ball away to prevent a throw-in. That's a delay, okay? And I score, knock the ball away, you can't take it out of bounds. That's a delay. You get one warning, and if you do it again, it's going to be a technical foul. That's a Class B technical foul. It's not assessed to a player. It's not assessed to a coach. It is assessed to a team, and it's a Class B, what they call administrative technical.
And that and so teams will get warned and then slapped with that.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
What else we got going on in terms of sort of?
Well, the other thing is, and I think they actually, from what I hear from the national coordinator, that football has made an effort to get the real plays that are excessive and unnecessary to make the game safer, and we're talking about football. The carryover is to basketball.
So we're talking, so just to backtrack for a second, when we're talking about football, what we're talking about is targeting.
Targeting.
So we're
yeah.
Targeting where they call a penalty on the play, and then they review it to determine whether A is a penalty and B is ejectable.
Right. And one of the points of emphasis this year...
In basketball,
is... They want to look at excessive and unnecessary plays that a player could get hurt. You can picture a player that is airborne going in for a layup that gets pushed in the back. That was called an F1, which is an intentional foul. But if that player goes down and there was a possibility of him being hurt, they can elevate that from an F1 to an F2, and an F2 is a flagrant foul, you get ejected. That's no different than targeting in football, where he may not have gotten hurt, but he could have gotten hurt because of the targeting. Yeah. So they're taking even, there's a clip that I looked at recently, and it's on the arbiter site that the officials look at. In an Xavier game, an Xavier player was tripped. As he came up the floor, he was tripped. That's an easy F1. It was deliberate action by the defense. That's an F1. He went to the floor. They took that from an F1 to an F2, and James Breeding, the referee, looked at that on the monitor, came back, and ejected the player.
So it's a play that didn't cause injury, but could have caused injury.
Could have caused injury.
And that's going to be a flagrant two and ejections this year.
It could be an ejection. And there was two of them called. Wilmington played Clemson, and they looked at not that particular play, but another play that we'll discuss. And they went to the monitor, and they didn't elevate it, but they were able to look at the monitor to see if it was an F2.
Interesting. So, to use an example we're all familiar with, if, say, Grayson Allen were to trip someone, and that player stumbles but doesn't fall, then that...
If he stumbles, that's different than falling to the
floor.
That's
what I'm saying. So yeah. it becomes a question of whether or not the player falls.
Is that
what we're dealing with?
No, the question is... The way it was explained to me, could that player have, from the action by the trip, could that player have been injured?
Hmm. So maybe the hip check of Luke May in the, Garrison Brooks in the ACC championship game, where Brooks was just kind of knocked off stride, would not come up for review, or would maybe be reviewed and not determined to be.
Was there a whistle on that play? There was.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
they could review that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But whereas if he tripped a player who then fell, that would potentially be an F2 now.
Potentially could, yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They really, when you listen to the NCAA video, they're really looking to make this game less physical. There's also a play that I talked to Brian Kersey. And it's on the video, the NCAA video. It's called a hook and lockdown play. Look, what players are doing now are getting players going up for rebounds and hooking their arm
mm-hmm.
underneath
sure.
them. Okay? They're hooking that guy. And the NCAA says that is a deliberate action. It's not just a common foul. That's a deliberate action. And there are some slick players that can do it on a drive,
mm-hmm.
hook the arm. And that is an F1 now. That's it. They want to get that play out of the game. That's an F1, which is an intentional foul. And it's called, they labeled a hook and hold play. And there's been a number of, but players have been coached to do that.
Sure.
And they want to get that out totally out of the game. And I mentioned the Clemson-Wilmington game.
Mm.
They had one on each team. And both coaches just shook their head and says, we have been alerted to that. We understand that. Had no issue with the way the play was called. But the hook and hold is another area that they don't want these players being held when they're trying to get up to rebound or drives to the hoop.
Interesting. Was that...
That's it.
That's it?
That's pretty much it. Other than, you know, they're back to get these hands off. They want to make the game free. What it's been working on for some time, even when I was a super, I had freedom of movement.
Freedom of movement, sure.
Freedom of movement. I tell you, I watched a couple games the other night, Kansas, of course, and Michigan State and Duke suffered through the 9:30, 10 o'clock Duke game. But I thought the referees were pretty much on target. The four best teams in the country, it wasn't too physical. It was up and down, pretty entertaining. didn't see any real physical play, but maybe I hope the game's getting that way.
Well, you know, it's kind of like what the NBA did a few years ago, where they started calling everything on the perimeter, and it was awkward at first, and then eventually now you have almost complete freedom of movement on the perimeter in that game.
Yeah, and talking to my son, Tim, he says, Dad, he says, a lot of this is helpful because the NBA is taking care of their business when it comes to the hook and hold. And if they catch a guy tripping in the NBA, he gets ejected. They're pretty stringent on those things. And so it may help the NCAA game.
Without any sort of rules or other emphases to points of emphasis to discuss, it seems like we should expect this season to look a lot like last season from an officiating perspective.
Yeah, I think there'll be some rule changes. They're talking about rule changes for next year, and I'm not sure exactly what that'll be, but I think the rules committee is pretty happy with the state of the game. They didn't indicate that, whether they were going to, in the rules committee, from what I understand, that they're happy with the shot clock. They're happy with the 3-point line, the restricted area. They put some serious changes in over the last couple of years in the restricted area. I don't see any major changes. They'll always target, how can we keep the game free movement, free playing, let the players that have the skill levels, rather than locking them down with the defense and holding. And I think the game's on the right track.
Okay. Another year for the ACC and Big East in their sort of Northeastern consortium of leagues with the Colonial and the A-10 and the Ivy, and I believe the MEAC join this year, which may take care of the perennial issue with the Saturday night Ivy League refs, where on Friday night, you got the only teams playing, you get A-10 guys, or you get good refs on Friday, and then Saturday you get whoever's left when everyone else is playing. Yeah. So hopefully that was all a Saturday night Ivy League refs were always an adventure. Hopefully that that takes care of that. I actually spent a day this summer over at NC State with Brian Kersey at his evaluation camp, looking for guys to bring in to the consortium, that the Big South Colonial level. That was fascinating. He moves that around every year to a different ACC coach's summer camp. And this year it was Kevin Keats's camp over at NC State. So that was interesting. A lot of kids of guys who worked for you over there working those games.
Yeah.
A lot of second generation guys
from
your era and guys who worked for you. But it seems, John, and we've talked about this before, but it seems like that idea, that concept is working well. And it there definitely seems to be some fluidity there. I mean, I think the idea of the fact that the ACC last year in Brooklyn basically picked 9 guys for the weekend, and instead of having the 3 top guys work the championship game, spread them out among the semifinals and final, and actually sent some guys to the A-10 championship instead of the ACC championship game. That was certainly a change in procedure, but it's kind of part of the way this new deal is working.
Yeah. Lou, first of all, I think the consortium and the alliance, or whatever they call it, with a group of schools is probably the best thing for the officials and for the leagues. There was always a bit of anxiety by coaches that would see officials night after night after night moving across the country, either up into the east or into the Midwest, and then they'd be flying back here to work an ACC game. And my tenure as the ACC supervisor, it was brought up more than a few times that are the officials getting enough rest? Maybe they're overworked. Can they keep their focus? And I never had the answers for that because they probably were tired. Certainly when they get into late January and February working at so many games, I'd be wrong to say if they weren't fatigued. But
that's not what you said when I asked you about it.
No. Well, you would hope they got there, but it's hard. I've been to Iowa State, and I've been to the Midwest, and trying to get back during a snowstorm, it's not the game that makes you tired, it's the travel. But when you put together some small Division Ones, and I don't want that to sound wrong, but the Big South and the Colonial, and then you got the Atlantic 10, and then you got the ACC, and you got the Big East, all working together for some officials, not all officials working the Big East, and not all the Big East guys working the ACC. But when you put that together, and logistic-wise, scheduling-wise, works for you, you can assign a guy to a Colonial game, an A-10 game, and a Big East game, or Big East ACC A-10. If you're at Rhode Island, you can certainly go to Boston College. And from Boston College, you can go to Northeastern. And you're going to get plenty of rest. You're going to be in Boston for 2 days. In Rhode Island, you're going to be in Boston actually for 3 days. So if you can work that out with officials and get some rest, there's no better situation. That referee is on his bed and after the game, getting plenty of rest. And that's the benefit of the consortium. Sometimes it doesn't work. And a lot of times officials don't want to give up another conference. There's ACC officials that still want to work in the Big Ten. And but for a lot of them, they get more games. The other thing about the consortium, you can put people in the Big East and the Colonial that aren't ready A-10 or even ready Big East or ACC.
Yeah, Big South and Colonial.
Big South. That's good basketball, and they get good training, and you can watch their progression. And the A-10's got terrific teams, and then the next thing you know, hey, this guy is a guy that can handle these A-10 games, and then you put him in the ACC. And I know the ACC has referees that went that route. So it's nothing but positive.
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago when I wrote a story about officiating, one of the questions that came up and that no one had an answer for is, at the time, was so if the LeBron James of officiating is out there, how do we find this guy? How do we get him, working, and how do we move him up when he's ready? And at the time, if you were yourself at the time as the head of the ACC, there wasn't a whole lot you could do. You know, you could keep an eye on the guy. You could encourage him. You could, try to find him spots, but you didn't have any control over this young official or his career. Now you can get him in at the Big South level or whatever, and start evaluating and working with them and critiquing, and it really creates sort of creates a pyramid, but it also creates opportunities for guys to move up, and even to a certain extent, guys to move down. If you're, older or whatever, and you still want to work a few ACC games, but you can't work, a 15, 20 game schedule, maybe you work a couple ACC games, but you work more in the A-10 or the Colonial, and without sort of the taking that shot to your pride or getting fired or, any of that stuff, it creates some opportunities for promotion and demotion and in theory should do a better job of identifying good young officials and moving them along.
Exactly. But, I conducted a number of camps. Some of the camps that you go to, I had similar camps. I had camps in Pittsburgh. I had camps in Atlanta, and I had different camps. And you'd see a guy that you'd say, man, this guy, he looks like a guy. He's refereeing these camp games. He looks like a guy we can use possibly. But those camp situations are so cosmetic that person could look very good or somebody you want to keep an eye on. And you move him in to your league in those games, in whether it's a Colonial game or a Big South game, is far different than those camp games. And I had some success, and I had certainly some failures. But the place to identify prospects are guys that can work Colonial, Big South, A-10 games, and watch them. And if they can handle those games, yes, you have a chance to move up. And like I say, you can also have a chance to, or there is a chance that you may not be able to do that. But the camps are too cosmetic is the word I use. They just up running up. They don't play any offense. They hardly play any defense. And it's hard to really get a feel for how good a guy could be. But you can get a feel for them if he's refereeing in the Colonial, and they're pretty good games. And Big South also.
This is technically a national podcast, but obviously because of what I do and what you did, we're ACC focused. You want to talk about the ACC a little bit?
Well, you know,
that was a yes or no question.
But yeah, I can talk about the ACC and probably say things that I could never say before, but you know, first of all, I want to say something about Brian Kersey, who took my position with the ACC. Top-notch referee. We had 16 schools. He could go to any one of them, and they were happy to see him. He never worked the Final Four until his last year before he took the ACC job. He had 100% support by the referees. And I had some reservations. Not that he was, I always thought he was the right guy, but I always thought, could Brian separate himself from being a referee who refereed with the staff that's there now, become their supervisor, and change his role completely? I had some real concern, and he's done it better than I would ever have given him a chance to do. I think he's just the right person. He's does all the scheduling. He gets after those guys when they don't make the effort that he wants, whether it's guys that he worked with year after year. He has no problem doing the job he needs to, and he's built a staff. When I was there my last few years, last couple of years, you know, I didn't take some of the guys in that he has taken in, and they have all pretty much proven that they're good referees, and the ACC staff is going to be young enough to continue forward when they lose some senior veteran guys. That staff is in terrific shape, and it's a credit to... Now, I didn't leave him with an empty cupboard, okay? He had some Final Four guys there to lead the way, but he's had some really good guys, and I think Brian's done a really good job.
I got to disagree with you.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. Brian, no, obviously Brian's... Hello, Brian, I believe is a listener. And some changes this year, too. Brian Dorsey apparently is back from his foot issues, according to you. Tony Henderson comes over from the SEC, you know, and obviously some more young guys we'll be seeing, I think, a little bit more of over the course of the year. But yes, no, I think as a sports columnist, especially one that was extraordinarily critical of the job you did at times.
Well,
Brian definitely has done a good job. I think the coaches seem happy about it.
Yeah, I think, and that was what I was going to say. I think, you know, you have to win the coaches over. You really do. And the one thing you can't do is you try to BS them. You have to be straightforward with them. They'll understand if his referees make a mistake. You can't always side with the referees, but you know, you talked about Brian Dorsey. He's coming off a two-year injury, and they lose Tim Nestor to retirement. And you're taking out 50 games from two veterans that that somebody had to make that up. And Brian has been able to do that. He's been able to fill those spots with that Brian Dorsey and well, it, actually, he hasn't been able to do it with Tim Nesser yet because Tim just tried. But he'll be able to fill those games with really quality referees. I think he's really done well.
Do you have any kind of relationship with either of the new ACC coaches, Chris Mack or Jeff Capel?
Jeff Capel, I do. Chris Mack, I don't. I really, you know, Chris was an assistant to Chris, Skip Prosser, but you know, I didn't have any action. But Jeff Capel, when he was at VCU, I refereed his games. Of course, I didn't referee when he was at Oklahoma, but when I were as a supervisor, when I went over to Duke, the times that I went over, Jeff would be out on the floor, and he would always make it a point to come over and talk to me. And I think, personally, I think Pitt had a great hire in Jeff Capel. And he'll take his beatings the first couple of years, but I think eventually, being the recruiter he is in playing in the ACC, Pitt, Jeff will have a lot of success at Pitt.
Did you ever call any of his games as a player?
I'm sure I did. I don't remember.
Not memorable ones?
Yeah, I'm sure I did.
What about his dad?
You know, I do know his dad.
You did know
him. Yeah, but cordially, being around, I did know his dad. Okay. Yeah. And I think Jeff took that pretty hard.
Well, no question about it. But yeah, I thought you might. You and
yeah.
And Jeff the Elder, certainly big wheels in North Carolina basketball.
Yeah. You know, we talked a little bit about ACC basketball before we went on. And I think the first game I watched this year was the Duke game against Kentucky. And you and I agree quite often about things, but... And we probably disagree, but if they play at that level and continue to play at that level, I don't know how you defend them. I mean, I was just like, they're big kids making threes. They get 33 points from Barrett. They get 28 from Williams, and they get Reddish gets 22 on their first night out. Against the number two team in the country, there was no freshman players on that floor that I saw from Duke. They were kids that played it. I had one referee say to me, a Big East referee, John. There's no substitute for experience. Just look at Villanova, who wins a national championship. Mm. He says, kids that are in the programs for a long period of time, play together, know how to play, know how to win. And his answer to me was, yeah, Duke was terrific. And they were. Everybody had agreed. But Villanova has proven a point by having experience.
I mean, I wasn't surprised by what happened with Duke. The Lexington paper asked 34 people in Kentucky, North Carolina, and nationally, writers, alleged experts, who was going to win. And of the 34, only two picked Duke, and I was one of them. And I wasn't surprised because I thought Krzyzewski would have them ready. That's the kind of game those kids were born to play. I don't think Duke will play that well all the time. I don't think Duke will shoot that well. I don't think they'll play teams that were as lost on defense as Kentucky was at times. The grind will get them. Like, I think Duke was extremely likely to win that game and extremely unlikely to win all three games in Maui. Now we'll see how that goes. But, this Duke team is going to be good to start the year. They're going to probably be good to end the year. But they'll struggle with the grind. They'll struggle in November and December and January. They may lose two of their first five ACC games, but that's all part of the process with a team like this. The talent is sort of unquestioned. I mean, I had RJ Barrett as my national player of the year, ACC player of the year, not rookie, but player. I mean, I just think he's a fantastic talent. But they'll struggle. They'll struggle at times. They're not going to go 40-0.
You know, you talk about the grind, but if you have enough players, and Duke has enough to come off the bench, to these guys don't have to play.
No, it's not about that. It's about school. It's about the routine, practices. You see it with a lot of teams, but and you saw that with the closest comparison to this team, which is Duke's 2015 team, which also had a Jones at point guard, also a group of freshmen who sort of recruited each other the way Okafor and Winslow and Jones did. This group has to a certain extent done the same thing and has that chemistry. That Duke team in 2015 struggled, had some chemistry issues with the Rashid Suleiman stuff, and then ended up going up to Virginia and didn't lose again. Well, I lost in the ACC tournament, but you know, the rhythms of the season are undefeated. Duke will struggle at times because of things happening off the court, because of injuries, because of whatever. But this is a team that certainly has the potential
to win a championship.
Yeah, to win a national championship. Yeah. There's no question about it. And certainly had the potential to beat Kentucky on Tuesday. I don't know that I saw them blowing them out like that. I was actually kind of surprised at Kentucky had to show. Was. But I wasn't surprised that Duke won. I do think there's, I think that there are other teams that could also win the ACC and may win the ACC over Duke. I had UNC number one in my preseason poll. Virginia is obviously Virginia. So it's going to be interesting.
Is the league overall real strong?
I think the top is. I don't think the middle is as strong as it has been, although it potentially should get 9 to 10 teams in, and the bottom is pretty bad. Wake Forest, Georgia Tech, Louisville, Pitt, they're all going to, I mean, that's kind of
true.
A mess.
Yeah,
that's,
I agree.
The bottom is weaker than it's been in recent years. And then the middle, I don't know that Florida State's as good as Florida State was. I'm not sure what to make of Miami. Syracuse is kind of Syracuse. Yeah, Boston College I think will be okay, but losing Jerome Robinson obviously really hurts them. Not that there's anything wrong with Robinson's decision, but you know, that was a player they could potentially have had back, and that would have been quite a team. But Kai Bowman's quite a player too. I think the top of the league with Duke and UNC and Virginia, and then sort of Syracuse in that next group. Virginia Tech is going to be really good.
Yeah, they're going to be good.
Although
yeah.
losing Chris Clark certainly hurts them.
Yeah,
that's going to change things a little bit there. So, and then Miami and Florida State are kind of Miami and Florida State. So it'll be very interesting to see how that shakes out. And Clemson, this is a team that loses some players off a Sweet 16 team, but still has two really good guards, and guard play really matters, especially in the ACC, especially in the NCAA tournament. So, that middle of the league, I'm not sure is quite as strong in terms of sort of Sweet 16 caliber teams, but I still think it's throw Notre Dame and NC State in there, there's 9 to 10 teams that probably should make the tournament.
Yeah. Well, Luke, I got to ask you before we close this session, because it's asked, I'm going to throw you a curve here a little bit, because we didn't talk about it much, but every day there's something new in the paper about the criminal cases that the NCAA violations, and I don't know how to word it exactly, but three guys getting convicted and Adidas people involved in payments to players.
The federal investigation into corruption in college basketball is your...
Yeah, and you're far more... I know what I read in the paper, but I think if you would, you can give us some of your take, because locally, one of our schools is certainly in the paper with Dennis Smith and payments, supposedly payments to his family, you read that the Miami name was mentioned, and you read where Louisville was mentioned. So the ACC and the schools that are whether it's Arizona and others, Creighton, but the ACC has three schools that I think that I've read And I think people that listen to our podcast, I get a question all the time, like if I knew something, which I know absolutely nothing, what's going to happen to our ACC schools? What's going to happen to NC State? I live here in Raleigh. What could happen now that the NCAA is given the go-ahead to start their investigation? That's big news, Luke. I mean, that's something that, if I go to play a round of golf and I'm on the practice tee, people are going to ask me about that.
So you're asking me what you should say to people who come up
to
you on the practice
tee? I tell you what people, I said, you read the same stuff I read. I said, but we've got Luke DeCock who knows it all, so you can.
you're
obviously,
right.
I know. But Luke, help us and understand what this is all how it's going to come down.
Well, I think in kind of like the situation with UNC, nobody knows because we're in completely uncharted territory here, and in a lot of ways. One, it's important to remember there's two separate sort of thrusts to this federal investigation. The first involved payments from Adidas through agents to get players to go to schools. And that's the trial that we just had, where Dennis Smith's name came up a lot. There's a second part of this where that hasn't gone to trial yet, which is assistant coaches like Book Richardson at Arizona, is probably the most prominent one, who took money from financial advisors to steer players to those financial advisors. That is actually a pretty straightforward bribery case. Those are probably going to plea out now that the recruiting part of it has gone the way it has with the guilty verdicts. So there's that. The guilty verdicts are interesting because the federal government's entire case is built around the concept that the schools, so let's say NC State, were the victim and they were defrauded when these people conspired to deliver them players who weren't eligible. But Dennis Smith was the biggest thing to happen to NC State's basketball program in years. And yet somehow NC State is the victim in this. I had a very hard time getting that particular legal construction through my head. Now, obviously, the jury bought it, and federal prosecutors have a terrific record in jury trials, so that's not necessarily surprising. But I feel like there's sort of a legal fig leaf over this whole thing that's kind of absurd. The idea that, you know, NC State was somehow defrauded by having Dennis Smith delivered to them when, you know, they stayed with Adidas when they had the chance to leave because of Adidas's appeal to basketball recruits. And now they're somehow the victim. So unfortunately that part of that ship has sort of sailed, with the guilty verdicts. I suppose there's a chance something could change on appeal, but so that part of it has always struck me as weird. I think all of us have always known that there was weird stuff going on. We've heard rumors attached to players, dollar amounts attached to players. You know, the sort of stuff from Kay and Roy about how that's not the world they live in. You know, surely they're aware of their former assistants being asked by AAU coaches for money. Certainly they might have been asked for money at some point. Even if they stopped recruiting the player at that point, they're still aware of it. It goes on. You may not have to pay players at a Duke or UNC, but other schools do. And the evidence presented at trial makes it clear that there is a black market for players. It's out there. And part of that is because a basketball player, as an AAU player, has value. As an NBA player, has value. But as a college player, has no value. And it cannot be compensated for his value. And so the economy, the free market is unbeaten, and it will find a way to deliver value to these players illegally if you can't do it legally. Obviously, the NCAA could get its head out of the sand. The Rice Commission sadly didn't deal with any of this, but letting players do endorsements, letting players take some money. I mean, these players have people who want to pay them, and the only thing keeping them from getting paid is the NCAA and its commitment to quote-unquote amateurism, which is really just a way for coaches and athletic directors and contractors to make money off these kids. And I know that probably for some people listening to this podcast, that's not a popular point of view, but I think you can enjoy college sports while also acknowledging that it exploits players, particularly in men's basketball and football. So there's that. And then there's also the situation of one of the Rice Commission's proposals that was approved was that the NCAA in its enforcement proceedings can now use other public records as evidence. Whereas before it would have to go back and re-interview all of these witnesses in this corruption trial, now it can use their testimony. So what does that mean for NC State? Well, it means that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that Dennis Smith's career at NC State was tainted, and not merely because of what a horrible team it was, in part because of him, but actually because he showed up allegedly having been bribed. And NC State's in bigger trouble than anybody, except maybe Kansas. That's debatable, because assistant coach Orlando Early was the bagman, allegedly. So no one knows what the NCAA is going to do with this stuff. The feds have just given the feds had asked the NCAA to stay away while they were preparing for trial. And this week, they've, according to Yahoo, they've given them the go-ahead to start investigating and preparing cases. I think there's probably cases to be made against, based on what came up at trial, against NC State and Kansas and Arizona and Louisville, at the least. Whether they will, who knows? And, you know, other schools came up. Creighton, you mentioned. You know, is the NCAA going to want to prosecute 12 top 25 teams? That doesn't help the value of their tournament very much. No one knows. And no one knew what the NCAA was going to do about UNC, and no one knows what the NCAA is going to do about this. But
well,
it's a mess.
You don't know. But you said something about there's evidence or anecdotal evidence. Does that, with that available, would the NCAA need to be 9 months to a year when there's already a trial that has produced the evidence? You know, like you said, the NCAA probably couldn't get their hands on all the things that the federal government got done. So, you know, a question, my first question would, how could this linger if some of the stuff is already there?
Well, probably because they're going to have to they're going to want to reinvestigate some of this, even if they have the testimony. And the other half of it is, who knows? We've never dealt with this before. The NCAA has never had access to this information. In the past, they've always had to start these enforcement cases from scratch without subpoena power, which they now have de facto subpoena power, thanks to the federal government. We'll find out. No one knows.
Something I didn't think about until a person brought it to my attention, like Dennis Smith, his father was the coach of his AAU team, okay? His AAU team was sponsored by Adidas. So why don't they just pay, which is legal, why don't they just pay Dennis' father whatever amount of money that they want to pay him?
Well, I think...
Or Bagley. Nike
gave Marvin Bagley Jr. a lot of money for Marvin Bagley III's AAU team.
AAU team. So we got Nike and we got Adidas. So
I would suggest, John, that the people we're dealing with here were dumb enough to get caught when no one else ever was, that maybe we're not dealing with the creme de la creme of the recruiting industry here.
Yeah.
In the case of Dennis Smith, very similar to Marvin Bagley. His dad runs the AAU team. Pay the AAU team. I don't know what to tell you.
That's not a NCAA violation for Adidas to pay Dennis Smith's father sponsor his team.
Sure.
Sponsor his team.
But it is an NCAA violation to give a bag full of money to Orlando Early to deliver to Dennis Smith. Yeah. That is the definition of an NCAA. I said earlier that the UNC football players who sold their shoes broke what may have been the simplest rule in the NCAA rule book. I don't have to retract that. Don't take a bag of money to give to one of your own players.
Yeah.
Is actually probably the simplest rule in the book.
First of all, you gave us an explanation that I was looking for, and far more articulate than probably anybody I know. But I don't know what, but I would have to think that there'll be some kind of NCAA investigation, but who knows?
Well, I mean, you get to a point, though, where this stuff comes up. They're going to punish everybody? You know, like obviously, yes. You based on what was at trial, there's a case to be made against NC State and Orlando Early and Mark Godfrey. No question about it. But Dennis Smith is gone. Orlando Early's gone. Mark Godfrey's gone. The school claims it did everything it could to stop this, and there's no reason not to believe them.
They probably out, yeah.
You know, I mean,
you could tell kids not to take money. I'm just talking, you know, yeah. In general, you can tell. You can sit there in front of the kids and Luke, here's my point.
What's the point of punishing NC State now?
Oh, other than they broke the rules, you know.
Right, but you're just going to punish kids who had nothing to do with it, a coach who had nothing to do with it, and soon an AD who had nothing to do with it. You know, yeah, you're. That's the part of the problem with the NCAA's discipline apparatus is you punish people who don't deserve to be punished as a deterrent to other people. But what deterrent is it if you know you're never going to be punished? That's a bigger issue.
Well, and I've said this before on part when I sat in our spring meetings with our coaches. I was a listener more than anything else, and I heard them to almost all of them, we cannot keep the agents away from our players.
Yeah, and curiously, the Rice Commission's answer to that was to get the agents more involved.
Let them be. Maybe that'll, you know.
I don't know. I'm with Roy on that one. That one didn't make any sense to me. That's Roy's big question. We'll find out, John, is the best answer I can give you, because in a lot of cases, we're in completely uncharted territory. None of this stuff has ever been. The disciplinary process is different because of the Rice Commission. They've never had access to this court testimony like this. It's all very interesting.
Is the federal government done with their... There's more to do, right?
There could be. Maybe they're done. Maybe they just wanted to get this prosecution and move on. Who knows? I'm still shocked it was a guilty verdict, to be quite honest. I don't know how you could... Anyway.
You can make the schools...
I don't know how a school can land a top basketball recruit and somehow be the victim.
Yeah.
I don't understand how... I understand that there's a legal case for it and that the law isn't always subject to logic, but that one makes no sense to me. John, so we're in year three here. I want to encourage our listeners, if they've made it this far... to send us, send me on Twitter at Luke Decock or email ldecock at newsobserver, all one word, newsobserver.com. If there's plays that you want us to talk about or look at, let's be honest, we want John to look at. Send me clips. We'll take a look at them. I'll put links out there for our listeners. We're happy to do that. We're a little short of controversy so far this year, but we're just getting started.
Yeah,
we're going to try to get some guests on this year. Maybe some of the ACC or lower level officials who live around here. We've got a couple NHL refs who live, only about 10 minutes from John's house. We might get them. We'll get JD Collins or Brian Kersey, to join us at some point. I will try to remember to solicit questions. If we know we have a guest coming. And again, you know, if there's a place in Raleigh that wants us to do this live, you know, why not, right?
So I think that'd be a lot of fun.
I don't know that this could get any better, John, but probably a pint of Guinness would help.
Yeah, exactly.
For our first go of the year, I kept you from banging on the table.
Yeah, I get carried away, but you know what I think I'm going to do is, we both know Brian Kersey could add to our podcast, and he's certainly going to get it in here to see the Triangle teams before long, and I'm going to reach out to Brian and see if he'll come on, and we'll stay away from controversial issues, but...
I don't think he cares.
You know,
maybe not coaches, but I've never known Brian to hold back.
Then he'd be a great guest, and maybe we'd do that. And another name that I think that I might reach out to is Tim Nestor's retired now. Spent a great career in the ACC. We came up through the ranks, and because of jaw obligations, had to step aside, but Tim's not far away up in Winston-Salem. I think if we ask him to plan ahead, maybe we can get Tim on.
Absolutely. Yeah, that'd be great. I think that'd be fascinating to hear about his officiating career and now life after officiating and how much he misses it or not.
And I think Tim would do that if his schedule permits and we can, like I said, plan ahead. I think it'd be good.
And if there's any famous people listening who want to come on as guests, reach out to John. I assume most of them have your number.
Yeah, most of them do. maybe we can get Dino Gaudio on our show.
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible.
That name just comes to mind because did I just see where Dino took a job? I think he's an assistant somewhere now. I can't remember, but that'd be great.
All right. Well, something to look forward to. We'll got this one in the books, and hopefully by the next time we talk, some controversial stuff will have happened for us to talk about.
So. Maybe so.
All right. Thank you, John, and thanks, everyone, for listening. We will be back soon.